Today is Thursday, July 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, trade tensions between the U.S. and the European Union for now seem to have been tamed.
The European Union, it will also make trade fairer and more reciprocal.
U.S. Senators grill Secretary of State Mike Pompeo about North Korea and the president's meeting with Vladimir Putin. It could be the key to finding life. Scientists say there's evidence of water on Mars. Also ahead, as fans pray for pop star Demi Lovato, it brings to light again an addiction epidemic. It's all on today's International Edition. Amid an Oval Office showdown over trade, the United States and European Union reached a truce, agreeing to talks, during which time they won't punish each other with additional tariffs. The U.S. and EU presidents, following their nearly 3 hours of White House meetings, announced they've agreed for now not to escalate a trade row between the two partners responsible for half the global commerce.
We agreed today to launch a close dialogue on standards in order to ease trade, reduce bureaucratic obstacles, and slash costs dramatically.
Speaking from the White House Rose Garden alongside European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, President Trump said that the two will work to reduce barriers and increase trade.
Already today, the United States and the European Union have a $1 trillion bilateral trade relationship, the largest economic relationship anywhere in the world. We want to further strengthen this trade relationship to the benefit of all American and European citizens. This is why we agreed today, first of all, to work together towards zero tariffs, zero non-tariff barriers, and zero subsidies on non-auto industrial goods.
The European Union had been preparing a list for 20 billion of U.S. goods to be hit with retaliatory tariffs, according to its trade commissioner, but Juncker said that will be placed on hold as long as negotiations continue.
We are close partners, allies, not enemies. We have to work together. We are representing half of the world trade.
Joining us now to talk more about this, Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, what did you take away from the news conference?
The main issue that came out of it was that for the time being, a trade war between the United States and the European Union has been averted. The real concern for the European Union was that the American administration was going to take that next step and put tariffs on cars being imported into the United States. That was what was really worrying the European Union. They were so concerned about any type of potential tariff on imports of cars and car parts into the United States that they were really already had a file full of all the names of all the companies and all the products that they were going to slap retaliatory measures on, retaliatory tariffs, if America went and went down this road. The fact that they were ready for a confrontation, they were really playing down expectations of this right up until the last minute, just shows that they really did not expect, particularly President Trump, to pull away so openly from these new tariffs. So, yes, they're pleased. Yes, it's better to have dialogue rather than confrontation. Yes, they're saying it is turning the page. But for the moment, they're saying, okay, it's a good start.
Is there an actual solid agreement? Is this sort of an agreement to continue discussing it?
It's an agreement to work together towards what President Trump described as zero tariffs, no barriers, and no subsidies. So it's an agreement to move towards that. Now, Europeans don't really believe this. They are still a little bit cautious because of the so-called Buy American Act, which protects American industries, particularly agricultural and farmers. It gives them support. So, it is good. It's better. The European Union, and particularly in the last few minutes, the German Economics Ministry has said, this is a good step. It averts a trade war. They don't know how long for. They think it's the right step. But this is certainly one of a potential actual deal. And you have to go back to less than 2 weeks ago, U.S. President Donald Trump was calling the European Union a foe. So in that short space of time, they've managed to go do this quick flick, and President Trump is talking about doing a good deal with the European Union.
Did he say anything about removing the current tariffs that he has already put out there?
No. Now, this is what they did agree was that they will look again at these tariffs on steel and aluminium. This is a concern for the Europeans. It's a concern, but not a big concern, because it doesn't really affect them to the extent where tariffs on cars would. But those particular tariffs will remain in place. And the retaliatory tariffs that the EU has imposed on specific targets in the United States, such as Harley-Davidson and bourbon whiskey, they will stay in place. But there will be no new retaliatory measures. At the same time, they've also agreed that the European Union will start building terminals to be able to start importing U.S. liquefied natural gas. And that's also very important and a big one for the Europeans, because there had been criticism that the Europeans were too dependent on the so-called Nord Stream gas that was coming through from the United States, from this Nord Stream pipeline that was bringing Russian gas along through Russia and into Germany. So there were concerns that there was perhaps too much there, and that Europe was better off and could be better placed in the future if it diversified and had imports from other areas as well.
Here in the U.S., the president was getting a lot of criticism from members of his own party for his stance on trade and tariffs. Do you see that the pressure may have played a part in his sort of softening stance or seemingly more agreeable?
At this time, no one's really putting any particular finger on what caused this change of mood. Some people are saying, well, he's coming under a lot of domestic pressure. Others saying that the threat of retaliation by the EU on U.S. goods was just so great. I mean, they were talking about slapping tariffs that would have cost the U.S. about $50 billion in national income. Perhaps it was that, but at the end of the day, no one really knows. And even though this agreement is there, no one is really celebrating, because they know in the past that it's one thing to have come to an agreement with President Trump. It's another as to whether that agreement stays in place and sees its way to fruition.
That's Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The White House delays the next Putin-Trump summit until 2019. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says North Korea is still making fuel for nuclear bombs. The U.S. base in southern Syria sends a signal to Iran. And South Sudan foes sign preliminary peace deal. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Testifying before a Senate panel, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Wednesday declined to divulge details of President Trump's private meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki last week. In a series of often testy exchanges with Pompeo, lawmakers of both parties expressed continuing concerns about the summit. The committee's top Democrat, Bob Menendez, said Congress and the American people have a right to know what Trump and Putin might have agreed to behind closed doors.
When the president meets alone with President Putin, it allows the Kremlin-sponsored state media and the Russian Ministry of Defense to provide more information, at least from their perspective, not only to the American people, but sometimes it seems to the members of the president's own cabinet. So I'd like to ask you some questions to get to understand what actually happened. Has the president told you what he and President Putin discussed in their two-hour closed-door meeting in Helsinki?
The presidents have a prerogative to choose who's in meetings or not. I'm confident you've had private one-on-one meetings in your life as well. You've chosen that setting as the most efficient way to...
I just asked you a simple question. Did you can't eat up my 7 minutes,
answer,
Mr. Secretary. Did he tell you whether or not what happened in those 2 hours.
Yes, Senator, the predicate of your question implied some notion that there was something improper about having a one-on-one meeting. I completely disagree with the premise of your question.
I didn't ask you a predicate. I asked you a simple question. I hope we're going to get through it. Did he tell you what transpired in the two-hour meeting?
I had a number of conversations with President Trump about what transpired in the meeting. I was also present when he and President Putin both gave us a sense of what they discussed in the meeting that followed immediately after.
Well, Pompeo also defended Trump's discussions with leaders like Putin, saying we can't make progress on issues of mutual concern unless we're talking.
Senator, I understand the game that you're playing.
No,
I get
no,
it.
You know, Mr. Secretary,
with all due respect,
I don't appreciate you characterizing my questions. My questions is to get to the truth. We don't know what the truth is. And the only way that we will know what the truth is, what transpired in those 2 hours, and in highly amazing period of time to spend alone, one-on-one, is by understanding at least that if you were briefed by the president, what he told you. I don't think that's unfair to know, to understand what policy is.
Pompeo also declared the United States does not recognize Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea. Well, we learned this week that pop star Demi Lovato was rushed to the hospital following an apparent overdose. Frightening to hear about someone who would appear to have it all, beauty, fame, fortune, but it is certainly a reminder that addiction doesn't discriminate. Lovato has been very open about her struggles with addiction. Joining us now to talk more about the issue is Harry Nelson, chairman of the Behavioral Health Association of Providers and the author of an upcoming book on the opioid crisis. Harry, so what do you think makes a person go back to using after being clean and aware that they have a problem?
I think it's different for different people, but for a lot of people, there are certain triggers that led to the use in the first place, things like anxiety, depression, stress. Those things become triggers in the future. And so I think what ends up happening is that the farther you get from the addiction, people still hold on to a craving for the relief. And opioids are such a powerful source of relief. They go to such a core part of our brain and our nervous system to give us, to make us feel better, to take away the pain, that it's very easy for those same triggers that originally led to it to come back and lead to relapse.
Use it to sort of cover up pain, to cover up depression, and then it ends up being highly addictive?
Yeah, the problem is the power of like opioids is that they essentially trick our bodies and our brains with like chemical structures that mimic endorphins and dopamine, the same things that make us feel good, that hit our pleasure centers, our reward centers, and reduce our pain. And the problem is that once you've identified yourself or you know, an addiction has led you to realize that you're somebody who is particularly vulnerable to this, it's a chronic condition and there's always the risk of allowing a trigger to take you back to that place.
At first we heard that she had a potential heroin overdose. Now we're not really sure. They're not really saying whether it was heroin or amphetamines, opioids. But either way, obviously it could be deadly. It can be deadly. What kind of condition would someone be in when they're discovered to have an overdose? Would they just be unconscious? Or how would you know that someone's suffering from an overdose as opposed to, say, a heart attack or something?
By the way, heroin is an opioid. Heroin's like become a huge part. Heroin and fentanyl are like the driving forces of the opioid crisis besides prescription medicine. But so part of it is like the way that we are built as human beings is when we feel better, when we feel less pain, when we feel calmer and happier, our breathing slows. And so what these medications do is they slow our breathing, they regulate our breathing and essentially depress our respiratory system. And so the problem is that, you know, when you naturally get those high feelings from like exercise, it's limited, but these drugs, whether it's heroin or some other drug, it goes too far. And the real problem is that if you're somebody who used in the past, when you were using it, you typically build up a tolerance because you're using the drug repeatedly. The effect dulls over time, and so you need to raise the dose. So when you have an addiction, very commonly you keep taking a higher and higher dose. And the problem is that when you've overcome the addiction and you stop taking, your body kind of restarts. And if you go back and use a dose that you would have been able to survive when you had built up a tolerance, it can put you in the hospital or worse, kill you.
And what do they do for someone in that condition?
If you can get somebody when they're still breathing or they just stopped breathing, then the drug that's typically used is called naloxone. It has a bunch of different brand names, but the best known is Narcan. And essentially what Narcan does, it's called an opioid antagonist. It's become the critical like weapon in fighting overdoses. Basically, as soon as you take Narcan, you basically immediately, as soon as it hits your bloodstream, it it immediately reverses the effect of the opioids and you wake up. And so if you can get it to people before they've stopped breathing, truly a lifesaver.
And that would be great, except that we know a lot of the people that have actually overdosed fatally, it wasn't their first time overdosing. And unfortunately, because these drugs are so addictive, sometimes we end up seeing the same person not be lucky the next time. Do you have any idea what the statistics are on overdoses in the United States?
The last year that we have reliable data for was at least 65,000. A lot of people think that number is too low because we're missing medical examiners. Coroners don't always use standardized data, so it may be much higher. A lot of people expect that when we get the 2017 data, we're going to see death toll for the year of all drug deaths go over 100,000. And so of those drugs, currently about two-thirds are opioid-related. So right now, we're talking about something on the order of 40,000 people died of overdose in 2016. I personally think that when we see the data from 2018, it probably has at least doubled, and we probably had about 75 to 85,000 deaths in the United States from opioids this year.
Wow, that's astonishing. Those are some frightening numbers for sure. So what's the best approach for loved ones who want to be supportive, not seem judgmental, but actually be helpful and supportive?
Just to be aware of the risk and to look for signs that somebody is engaged in at-risk behavior, and then think about prevention and intervention. Key is to start conversations early, to not be afraid to talk, whether we're talking to our children, our loved ones, our friends, our coworkers, to not be afraid to talk about it, as you said, to talk about it non-judgmentally, and then to encourage people to get help, to let people know that there are resources, to express concern, remain engaged, and if the person will let you, to intervene and to help get them to a doctor and get referrals to treatment.
All right, Harry Nelson, chair of the Behavioral Health Association of Providers. Thanks for being with us. Well, scientists announced Wednesday they've discovered what appears to be a body of salty liquid water beneath the surface of Mars, raising the possibility of detecting life on the red planet. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
A huge lake of salty water appears to be buried deep in Mars. The discovery, based on observations by a European spacecraft, generated excitement from experts. Water is essential to life as we know it, and scientists have long sought to prove that liquid is present on the red planet. The estimated 12-mile-wide reservoir lies below ice about a mile thick in an area close to the planet's south pole. The findings are published in the journal Science. NASA's InSight Mars lander is expected to start digging under the surface of the planet in November. Julie Walker, New York.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, as all five species of rhino in Africa and Asia are endangered or facing extinction, an Australian-based professor and conservationist is suggesting Australia may be a good place for some rhinos to be protected and rebuild their numbers within the confines of cattle stations or other enclosed areas. Bill Lawrence is a distinguished professor at the James Cook University in Cairns. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about efforts by scientists, European scientists, who recently created hybrid embryos from sperm of the last deceased northern white rhino in a laboratory.
This is really getting down to sort of Jurassic Park type desperation, but the last male of the northern white rhino died in March, so there's two females left. So they're using frozen sperm and harvested eggs, and they've created essentially embryos in test tubes, and now what they're going to do is actually try to implant those in a southern white rhino female. So you're going to kind of have a little bit of a hybrid offspring, and that it'll be genetically a northern white rhino, but it'll be born to a southern white rhino mother. It's not an ideal situation, but this, as they say, desperate times call for desperate measures, and this is really getting down to extremely difficult situation.
Well, when we talk about rhinos in general, there are a number of subspecies, but the animal itself is endangered, isn't it?
Yeah, there's five species of rhinos, and they're all pretty much in bad shape. The one that's in the best shape of all is the southern white rhino, but it was knocked down to a century ago. There were only 20 individuals of it alive at all, and it's made an amazing comeback to about 20,000 today. For the other four species of rhinos, so two of those are in Africa and the other three are in Asia, they're all desperately endangered. For instance, the Javan rhino, there's only about 60 of those left, and they live in just a little tiny area out in western Java. The Sumatran rhino, all biologists will say, and we work in Sumatra, is that it persists in a few little pockets there, but we don't say where because we don't want poachers to get in there and wipe out those last individuals.
Poaching, how big a problem is it?
It's an enormous problem. It's a combination of things because the rhino's habitat is being, you know, destroyed and shredded and chopped up, especially by this huge expansion of roads that we're seeing happening all over the world. In particular, China is driving initiatives to expand roads all through the Asia-Pacific region and in Africa and Latin America and in Africa and in Asia. That, of course, is oftentimes putting roads right into some of the last wild places where rhinos survive. And that lets the poachers in, and then we've got poachers with automatic weapons coming in, and they're just gunning down the rhinos. And unfortunately, rhinos are, you know, they're big, they're kind of nearsighted, they're fairly predictable in their habits, so they're easy to shoot. Sadly, what the poachers do is just machine gun the rhinos, and then they chop off the horn and they leave the animal to rot. They don't use the skin, they don't use the meat or anything like that. It's just removing the horn, which can be worth thousands to even tens of thousands of dollars.
Now, you're part of a process of possibly letting rhinos run free in Australia. What's behind this?
The thing about Australia is we're seeing rhinos being wiped out of mostly developing nations with rapidly growing populations and relatively limited rule of law and lots of weapons. Well, Australia has large expanses of tropical and subtropical savannas and woodlands and rainforests, which is the kinds of environments where these rhinos live. And it turns out rhinos are not especially picky about what they eat. And pretty good rule of law, and Australia doesn't have firearms. It's much more limited and controlled here. So there really isn't, you can't really imagine that kind of poaching problem happening here.
All right, that's Lawrence. Lawrence also says enormous bureaucratic obstacles would have to be overcome to introduce the rhinos into Australia, and many countries would justifiably be reluctant to give up their rhino populations. But he said as the situation becomes more desperate, it may be considered a serious option. He said he's received support from within the scientific community for the proposal as a way to bring back rhinos and possibly other endangered wildlife so that one day they could actually be reintroduced back into their native habitats. Well, most pet owners are ready to share stories of how their pets have consoled them or responded to their owners during a time of distress. Most are just cute pet stories until now, as new research shows that dogs actually feel empathy for others. Sadie Witkowski has the story.
Although Lassie, the well-known collie who starred in her own TV show in the 1950s, was famous for rescuing her young owner Timmy in almost every episode, the actual scientific research on animal pro-social behavior, or their desire to help others, has been rather limited. Early work on animal empathy has primarily been done in rats. The problem with using rodents is that it's hard to tell what a rat is feeling or what its motivation really is. Because a rat's intentions are unclear, Emily Sanford at Johns Hopkins University decided to try the experiments on domesticated dogs.
There is an established link of empathy from dogs towards humans, and we wanted to see, since humans can be told to cry or to hum on command, we wanted to see if we could induce an empathetic response in dogs.
Sanford and her research co-authors tested dogs' pro-social reaction in a simple door-opening task. Their owners sat in a small room, and were instructed to either cry or hum a tune. Researchers then recorded how the dogs reacted and whether they pushed the door open to check on their owners.
We actually expected that dogs would be more likely to open the door if their owner was crying than if their owner was humming. And that's not what we found, which was surprising. But the thing that was really interesting that we found was that among dogs who did open the door, dogs whose owners were crying opened the door significantly faster than dogs whose owners were humming.
The speed of the dog's response was also predictable, depending on their bond with their owner. That bond was tested using what's called the impossible task. Researchers placed the dog in a room with both their owner and a stranger, and an inaccessible treat. The researchers then timed how long it would take the dogs to look at their owner for help, compared to asking the stranger for help. They found that dogs that gazed at their owner longer during the task also opened the door faster when their owner was crying.
Your dog is a member of your family and does care about you, and you should be sensitive to the fact that your dog can understand your emotions when you're communicating with them, and so love them and treat them like a member of your family.
That's a scientific fact most pet owners already knew. Sadie Witkowski, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 24th to the 26th, the United States is hosting the first ever ministerial to advance religious freedom. Foreign ministers, international organization representatives, religious leaders, and civil society representatives are convening in Washington, D.C. to discuss concrete ways to combat religious persecution and discrimination and ensure greater respect for religious freedom around the world. U.S. Ambassador for International Religious Freedom Sam Brownback called the ministerial the launch of an expanded conversation about the fundamental right of all individuals to do with their own souls whatever they choose. It is a right, he said, no government should interfere with.
It's a right that a government is instituted to protect, not to pick a winner or loser, not to favor one religion over another.
Ambassador Brownback said protecting and promoting religious freedom is the right thing to do because of the innate dignity of every human being. But there are also practical reasons to do so.
Countries that have more religious freedom have less terrorism. We want to see the economy expand, and countries that have religious freedom have more growth in their economy.
Many governments say they value religious freedom, Ambassador Brownback said. The ministerial is an opportunity for countries to learn ways to put concrete actions behind the words.
They can appoint ambassadors for religious freedom or special envoys for it. They can host events in their own nation or region to promote religious freedom. They can form roundtables, civil society, religious groups in their country that promote religious freedom, and the government officials regularly meet with them to hear what the concerns are of the faith-based community.
Ambassador Brownback said that protecting and promoting religious freedom is in the United States' founding DNA. The Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom is an opportunity for other nations to be encouraged to take the next steps to really drive this further in their nation, in their region, amongst their people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.